Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Eric Weinberg continues our series exploring the book Cultivating True Compassion by Trungpa Rinpoche. In this section, Cultivating Bodhicitta, Part 1, The Three Stages of Developing a Loving Heart, Trungpa Rinpoche begins by showing how great masters studied and practiced bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, and then describes how we begin our practice and then develop in love through three stages of development. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everybody. Is this mic close enough to me? Okay, good. Sometimes I get that wrong. Thank you for coming out on this sultry day in Columbus. Feels like New Orleans out there to me today. And no Mardi Gras. What a shame. A lot of people thought Lama Kathy would be giving this talk today. The schedule was different in two places. She emailed me early in the week and said, hey, you know you're doing the Dharma talk? And I was like thinking, I said, no, you're doing the Dharma talk. Well, so we went back and forth and she said, you can say whatever you want. You can, you know, she put in there, in her note, it was going to be Eric Weinberg subject to be announced. And I declined to make something up on the spot. Instead, I thought it'd be really valuable to continue in this book that we're working on, Cultivating True Compassion by Trungpa Rinpoche. It's an excellent book. It's very pithy, also very helpful. And last week, I gave the Dharma talk, and it was chapter one. So now we're into chapter two. The title of chapter two is Cultivating Bodhicitta. This particular chapter has a lot of, there are three of this and two of that, like many Buddhist texts have. So I will try to get through the whole chapter, if not, and I don't know if I'll make it in the time allotted. If I don't, though, we'll just stop and start, pick back up wherever it is that I stopped. But I think it's valuable to cover it. There are also a few good stories, which I'll just read right from the book. Me, I like the stories. So, cultivating bodhicitta. I've got a cultivating joke. It has nothing to do with the talk. Sai Ginsberg was in an English as a second language class. He had immigrated to the United States after living 60 years in Ukraine. And as we all know, Ukraine got a little crazy recently. And in the English as a second language class, the teacher asked him, can you spell the word cultivate? And he said, sure. C-U-L-T-I-V-A-T-E. Teacher said, very good. Can you use it in a sentence? And Sai says, well, sure. I was waiting for the bus, and then I had to go inside before the bus got there because it was too cold to wait. I don't think that's anything like what Trungpa Rinpoche had in mind for an introduction, but yeah, so be it. So the way we start these Dharma talks is to chant the four-line refuge prayer together. And I invite you all, whoever knows it, to join with me in chanting it. If you don't know it, please follow along in your heart. The four-line refuge prayer was actually written around the year 1000 by the fella who wrote the book, Lamp for the Path of Enlightenment, which this book is based on, is a fella named Atisha. And so it's a nice connection. If you know the prayer, that's great. If you don't, it simply says, until I reach the heart of enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha, who's the teacher, the one who shared these teachings about 2,600 years ago. The Dharma, which is the teachings and the commentaries and the lives lived by those trying to follow the path ever since. And the Sangha. And the Sangha is twofold. It's all of us who are just stumbling down the path together and supporting each other. And it's also those who have actually achieved some realization and can be real spiritual friends and real help along the way. So if you can keep in your heart the idea that there was a Buddha who cared so much about relieving suffering for you and every other being that ever was, is, or will be. The teachings we all must make ourselves responsible for if we're to eliminate suffering for ourselves and others. And sort of a commitment of love and, what shall I say, unquestioned positive regard for each other. You kind of have it, so you don't need to know all this Tibetan we're about to chant. Sanje Chudong Soki Chok Nam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Su Chi Daki Jun So Ki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudong Soki Chok Nam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Su Chi Taki jinso gipe sunam ki Drola penshir sanje drupar shok Sanje chudam soki chok nam la Jang chu pardu dakni kyab su chi Taki jinso Yipe sunam ki Drola penshir sanje drupar shok. Just take a moment and imagine that in some sort, form and fashion, those three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, are made of light, are above your head, and dissolve into you, mixing into you inseparably, and finding a home in your heart. And all of this is possible because of our intention to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. Thank you. So this particular approach, and there are many approaches, to the study and practice of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta means awakening mind. In our tradition, the Kagyu tradition, dates back to the time of Gampopa, Is there? There used to be a Gampopa in the old place, and we'll get one again. He's one of the founders of this lineage. And what Gampopa did, he was kind of the heart student of Milarepa, who was his guru. And Milarepa had a dream and was talking to another one of his disciples, and he said, "Hey, tomorrow a great Kadampa master is going to come here, and he will learn the Mahamudra tradition from me. And then he will put it together with the Kadampa tradition and form something extraordinary and powerful that has never been seen before." And sure enough, the next day, Gampopa shows up, and he was the great Kadampa master. And he did become one of the heart sons of Milarepa. And he did put those two streams together. And then he moved out of Dodge. He was from central Tibet. I mean, he went back to central Tibet in the south, and he established a great monastery to learn, to contemplate, and to practice this particular union of these two traditions. The Mahamudra tradition that Milarepa's guru, Marpa, brought to Tibet, and the Kadampa tradition that Atisha brought to Tibet. And the place where he did that was called Dakpo. And that's why, to this day, a lot of people, and you'll see in a lot of literature, reference to the Dakpo Kagyu. That's us. That's who we are. It's just the name of the place that Gampopa eventually went to. Milarepa also predicted that after Gampopa had received the complete instruction, that he would have the greatest impact, ever through these teachings on for the benefit of mankind. And the way that he did that, he had a dream. He said he dreamt that a vulture flew away from him. Vultures in Tibetan, we think they're kind of ugly and kind of, you know, vultures. In Tibet, they're really revered and honored for a whole bunch of different reasons. For one thing, when they're flying, they just soar on the flow and the current of the air, and they're beautiful. And there are other reasons too. So he dreamed that this vulture flew away from him and alighted on a mountain. And the mountain represented the seat of Gampopa and Dakpo. The vulture was immediately surrounded by a very large number of geese. Most of them were yellow, some of them white. Each of the geese attracted many more geese to itself as a retinue, until finally the entire scene in the dream was filled with the predominantly yellow color of the geese. According to Milarepa, this was an indication that Gampopa would be the source of tremendous benefit to many beings. The reason Gampopa was of such benefit was his combination of these two streams of instruction. Just as a note, a side note, colors in Tibetan iconography have meaning. It's part of Tibetan psychology. Yellow is considered the color of enriching. So this was a sign that this union of these teachings would be really enriching. And white, there were a few white ones, that is the color of pacification. So pacification comes from the purification of our afflictive or negative emotions, negative mind states, and so on. So along with this purification that happens when you undertake this path, there comes the power of deep, deep enrichment for yourself and others. That's really what Gampopa did for us. So there are a few classic texts. Almost everything is based on Shantideva's The Bodhisattva's Way of Life. We've talked about that a lot. And that's an even older book from India. Gampopa himself wrote a book, and it's detailed, called The Jewel Ornament of Liberation. And then there's this one. I mean, this is the commentary on the book, but the actual text isn't much bigger than this. So we're going from Shantideva to Gampopa to Atisha. And the difference here is not that there's anything missing here. There's nothing missing here. It's complete. But it's totally oriented toward practice. And so it's quite valuable because we can digest it. We're not monastics doing a sacred reading every day. We have to do other stuff. So having a good practice manual is very valuable. So, Atisha's book is Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. And the way this came about was that, you know, early on, somewhere around the 8th century, maybe 9th century, there was a king in Tibet named Trisung Detsen, and he invited a great guru, Padmasambhava, and that's him there, to Tibet to teach the Buddha Dharma. Also, a great abbot of a great monastery, Shanti Rakshita, came. And so he actually, you know, Padmasambhava gave kind of the view. Shanti Rakshita gave the spit and polish, kind of how to practice. And between the two of them, along with this great Dharma king, they had a flourishing Buddhist culture in Tibet. That was actually the time that the language in Tibet, the written language, was developed. Tibet didn't have a written language before that. The written language was developed precisely to communicate the Dharma. They just didn't need one. They were nomadic herdsmen and women before that. So it's an interesting language in that it is tuned to transmit these teachings. After several generations, however, an heir to the throne, a relative of this great Trisung Detsen, a guy named Lang Dharma, came to the throne, and he was having none of it. He did not like Buddhism. He didn't like all this, whatever he didn't like about it, he didn't like about it. Anyway, he corrupted everything and literally destroyed monasteries and did things to try to stamp it out. And by the time he was done, there was just a remnant of Buddhist practitioners left in Tibet. And the practices that they had, because the teachers had been disappeared in one way or another, had become corrupted. And I'm not sure what they mean by corrupted. They just call them corrupted. So it wasn't pure. wasn't the authentic stuff anymore. After that, however, another king arose. I love this name. King Lama Jangchup. Ooh. Yeah. And he liked the Dharma. And he realized it had been previously pure and great, and it had been become corrupted, and he couldn't figure out, and nobody, the practitioners couldn't figure out how to actually sort through and make it right again, really bring the authentic practices together again and let go of the stuff that was just basically, usually corruption has to do with selfishness and the desire for power and so on and so forth. And they just couldn't figure out how to do it. So he decided, I am going to invite the greatest living master from India to Tibet to help us sort this and figure out how we get it right going forward. And that guy was this fella, Atisha. Atisha did two things. He did a lot of things, but two main things. One was he was called the Lord of Refuge. He taught refuge everywhere in great depth and with the profound meanings so that people could begin right from the beginning. Refuge is kind of the front door for entering into the Buddha Dharma. And he taught this. He taught bodhicitta. And he wrote this book as a manual for it. And that was in 1044. So that's where we're at. There are three stages of cultivation of bodhicitta. It's cultivate. We must cultivate. And it boils down, what they mean by stages, I think it actually is, I don't know why they call them stages. It's really three different motivations. What's called the lesser motivation is concerned with Dharma practice for your own happiness. And to get it quick, it's like, I'm suffering, I want out of this situation now. It's not concerned with anybody else, and it's not concerned with long-term happiness. It's like concerned with triage, you know? There are wounded players on the field. Let's fix this fast. There's nothing wrong with this. It's called lesser, but I don't know. It's nothing wrong with that. It's based on abandoning wrongdoing and cultivating virtuous action. Obviously, that's good. It's not concerned with others, though, and therefore it's not vast. And it's not concerned with long-term benefit, and therefore it's not profound. That's why it's called lesser. The second is average motivation. It's more profound because it's looking for complete transcendence. So it's like, okay, I'm suffering, but I want out, and I want out for good. What do I have to do? What's the path for that? But it's still only concerned with the individual, just me. I'm going to get myself out. I'm going to get to heaven, heaven or bust, you know? Me and Nirvana, you know? Whatever. I want to hang out in the country club in the sky. It's all going to be good. Beautiful. That's average motivation. Then there's the greater motivation, which we call the Mahayana. Mahayana means great vehicle. It's vast because it's concerned with and actively seeks the liberation of all beings without exception. When we say all beings without exception, that includes ourselves, of course. But it also includes beings that we don't normally consider, not just humans, but basically every living thing, everything that has consciousness, even stuff that's invisible to us. It's profound because it's not temporary. It's lasting. And the commitment to this particular motivation is what's called bodhicitta, or the mind of awakening. So there's a thing, a ceremony that we have called the Bodhisattva vow. It's about making that commitment that I will achieve enlightenment, total liberation for myself and all beings without exception. And until I reach the heart of enlightenment, I'm going to continue. I will continue. And I'm never going to give up. So it's long-lasting even before you get enlightened. It's like it starts now and all of a sudden you become vast. And vast is good. Vast is really good. It can seem a little daunting and seem a little unreasonable and impossible. That doesn't matter. You take that to the path too, and you realize that those feelings arise from bewilderment and not seeing things clearly. And so you just add to it and you say, I vow to see things more clearly so I can see how this is. Why do we do that? Well, it's because we've got examples going back 2,600 years of people who have actually accomplished this. So we know that it works. And then they leave us things like this text, and they tell us how we can do it too. Unfortunately, at least from my point of view, unfortunately, you can't go buy a magic mala or get just the right blessing from just the right lama, or collect 1,000 empowerments, or do magical practices and get this. It won't come that way. And they tell you that. The way it comes is through your own direct experience. That's it. This is the, you're going to see, you're going to be like that in the future. You will become a Buddha. Just hearing this actually plants the seeds. You kind of can't get out of it. One way or another, these seeds will eventually sprout and ripen and come to fruition. And you know what? When you're a Buddha, this enlightened attitude is going to seem ordinary to you. Because it will be. That's the way you are. Just like right now with our afflictive emotions and our negative mind states and so on, we just think, well, that's just normal. That's just being human. Well, that is. That's the way we are. The truth is, though, that all of those things are not permanent. They will go away. And there will be what the politicians call a new normal. And it'll be a better normal. And that's the point of the Dharma. We're going for a Buddha normal, if you will. So there are two types of bodhicitta. There's relative bodhicitta, which is emphasized in this book, and ultimate bodhicitta, which is not emphasized in this book. It's weird that the ultimate wouldn't be emphasized. The reason is that there are two parts of the path. There's calming down and there's waking up.
Hi, this is Don, the editor of the podcasts. At this point in the recording, we experienced a technical difficulty and lost a minute or two of content. The rest of the Dharma Talk continues in its entirety following this announcement. Sorry for the interruption.
Not to be true. And so we focus on the relative truth, and because that's where we are. Even though, as Trungpa Rinpoche says, it's what we're experiencing is ignorant or bewildered cognition, and it appears to us that we do actually exist the way we think we do, which is crazy. Because I look at myself and the way I think I exist as a fat old man. And what Trungpa Rinpoche is inferring is, yeah, well, okay, that's, you're not your body. You're actually a Buddha, or at least a Buddha to be. You have the potential. But we've got to start where you actually are. There's this idea in Mahamudra that our minds are like mirrors. And in that mirror, everything that appears and exists is reflected. If you think about it, even though we think everything is out there, it really appears in the 5 inches between the ears, right? Where else could it be? But we see the reflections in the mirror, in our own minds, the mirror of our own minds, and we think it's other. And that's where the mistake is. Rather than trying, though, to make a leap that we can't make to see how things are directly, just because we don't have the tools to make it, it's a little like telling a first grader who's learning arithmetic that the real truth is calculus. And you can show them all the derivatives and all the integrals, and it will just be, maybe they'll think it's pretty pictures because they have those nice curlicue lines and stuff like that. We're in first grade and we're learning arithmetic here, and it's going somewhere. We have to trust that. So that's how the presentation of bodhicitta goes. We start with the idea that, yeah, I actually think I do exist the way I think I exist. And you all exist the way I think you exist. So now, how do we work with that? Well, Atisha was concerned with that because he recognized, even as a great scholar, before he came to Tibet, a great Buddhist scholar, far along the path, way farther than us, that he was still suffering and he was still causing other people to suffer where he was at Nalanda University. You know how professors can be. They cause a lot of suffering. So he didn't like that. He didn't think it had to be that way. And he went, if you can imagine this, from northern India to Sumatra. Sumatra's a far way from northern India, and back then there were no jet planes, needless to say. You can just imagine what a journey like that was. In order to find his guru, the teacher who held the teachings of this, of bodhicitta, and his name was Dharmakirti, and Dharmakirti started Atisha with this idea of working directly with appearances the way that they appeared to him. Our meditations, like of Tonglen, come from that tradition. And Dharmakirti said, when Atisha asked him, Atisha said, why should I mess with this? Why should I mess with this false reality when I know it's a false reality, why can't you just immerse me in ultimate reality? And Dharmakirti said, because I am planting a seed. And a seed needs fertile soil, which includes manure, by the way, and water in order to grow. If we planted it in your mind trying to trick itself into thinking it was ultimate reality, it'd be like planting the seed in desert sand, it would never grow. This will grow with all the muddy mess and manure that you're bringing to me right here. And it will be transformed. You know, seeds are a complete package. They are genetically what they will become, but they look nothing like what they will become. And there are stages. Seed cracks open first, and then drops a root second, and it puts up a shoot third, and then there are leaves which begin to do something powerful that the thing never could do before as a seed couldn't have even imagined, which is photosynthesis. And then with all that nourishment coming into this amazing plant that had never existed before, except that it sort of did potentially, you know, flowers bloom and so on and so on and so on. We've all seen it. We're just like that. So it's crazy to cultivate bodhicitta from where we are on the basis of philosophy and like an understanding of ultimate emptiness and so on and so forth. That's just going to be planting seeds in the desert. Not very helpful. It's better to take everything that we experience as it is to the path. There are methods for this in both sutra and tantra. This book is concerned mostly with sutra and has a little tantra at the end. So, he tells another story here. I know I'm belaboring this point, but Trungpa Rinpoche belabors this point, so I'm going with him. So here's the story. Relative bodhicitta as a motivation is incalculably powerful and unbelievably beneficial. When we try to generate bodhicitta, we often think we are not really doing very much, but that's untrue. Think of everything that happened in the Buddhist tradition from the time of the Buddha 2,600 years ago up until now. During that time, the Buddhist teachings have survived and are still being taught. The teachings about meditating on love for all beings, meditating on compassion for all beings, cultivating bodhicitta, and so on. Through these teachings, innumerable individuals who lacked love have become loving. Innumerable individuals who lacked compassion have become compassionate. And innumerable individuals who lacked bodhicitta have generated bodhicitta. With these teachings, innumerable individuals filled with anger have been pacified. Innumerable individuals filled with jealousy have become free of jealousy. Because of the teachings on relative bodhicitta, tremendous benefit has been generated for the practitioners themselves and for those with whom they have come in contact. And this has all come from one source. I mean, how crazy is that? Think about vast. It's vast. The Buddha's teaching. And the Buddha's teaching arose from one cause. the Buddha's awakening. And the Buddha's awakening resulted from one cause, which is the Buddha's previous cultivation of relative bodhicitta. The Buddha once said, "Once when I was born in a previous lifetime, in poverty, I offered a Buddha, also known as Buddha Shakyamuni, a bowl of soup. And that has led to all this." The Buddha said that in the sutra. The story the Buddha was referring to was the occasion of this first generation of relative bodhicitta. It occurred when, having been born in a situation of extreme poverty, he nevertheless met the Buddha of his time. That Buddha was also known as Shakyamuni. Seeing him, he felt inspired with great faith. Having nothing else to offer, he offered him a bowl of soup that he held in his hand. When he made this offering to the previous Shakyamuni, he made this aspiration: "Through this offering, may I come in the future, to have your very name, a body like yours, a retinue like yours, awakening like yours, and may I achieve the same benefits for beings." That's actually a phrase that you'll find in various pujas that we practice. The circumstances seem unremarkable. A very poor person offering what seems outwardly insignificant, a bowl of soup, to a Buddha. Nonetheless, that one action on the part of that being who subsequently attained enlightenment as the historical Buddha Shakyamuni has led to all the positive benefit of the Buddhist tradition. It actually has led to you being here today. Pretty incredible. So, in this same way, when we ourselves generate bodhicitta, although it may seem very small and insignificant, it will without a doubt lead to tremendous results in the future. So, what is bodhicitta? Bodhicitta has two specific characteristics. It has unlimited compassion. Unlimited compassion means compassion for those who are obviously suffering, of course. But it also means compassion for those who seem to have it all. I think with the news of the last week, we can see just how important that can be. What was the old song? You can't judge the honey by looking at the bee. You can't judge the sugar by looking at the cream. You can't judge a sister by looking at her mother. And you can't judge a book by looking at its cover. So don't be stopped by what your perception is. That's part of the thing I was saying earlier. Admit to yourself that seeing isn't necessarily believing. You might not be seeing things as they are yet, and therefore generate compassion for everyone. Happy and unhappy, rich and poor. Why? Because all of it is impermanent. Those who seem to have the world at their beck and call, well, that's impermanent. And those who don't, that's impermanent. And those who are absolutely suffering, that's impermanent too. I had a guy in my office was talking after Anthony Bourdain apparently took his life. He said, he admitted to me that he too was actually a little depressed. This really triggered something in him. And I had just gotten a letter from a guy named Bob Van Hook, who's on death row. He's literally got a date for July 18th. And Bob wrote basically, well, it was good to see you last week. And I've been practicing the visualization you told me to, and I've got a little picture of the Buddha and a little picture of Jesus on my cell door facing me, so they're always looking over me, and you know, I actually feel pretty good. And I'm happy to be preparing for this, you know, for what's about to happen. And it's striking in this, in that very way, to think that somebody who seems to have the world at their beck and call, like Anthony Bourdain seemed to have, was so bereft. And a guy who's got less than nothing, I mean, a death row inmate literally in solitary right now for various reasons. Bob could get a little wild. And looking at a July 18th execution date, is at peace and happy and progressing on the path. If you ever, ever forget that happiness is an inside job, just remember Bob and remember this week. It's a pretty poignant picture. I think it's not easy to remember it all the time or remember the trainings in bodhicitta, but I'll give you two tricks that I have. I keep tricks because not being an enlightened being or being able to remember all this all the time, you know, the two of this and three of that. I try to remember two things, simple things. One is the title of a book by Nisargadatta, who is a great teacher. And the title of that book is I Am That. So walking around the streets during the day, I can look at people, I can look at each of you, and rather than thinking of others as others, I think I am that. I really care about whether I'm happy or sad. If I can remember that I am that, I also will care about whether you're happy or sad. The other is the title of a movie about Garchen Rinpoche. And that the title of that movie is For the Benefit of All Beings. And what I try to remember when I'm about to do something is that. I remember I'm doing this for the benefit of all beings. It changes the whole tone and quality of the way my day goes. Just to remember those two phrases that are very short. I am that, three words. And for the benefit of all beings, about five words. They're kind of like mantras in English for me. So the first aspect is of bodhicitta is compassion for all beings without exception. And the second aspect we discussed a little bit last week, which is discernment or intelligence. And that means that I may be doing triage sometimes, but I really have a view to the ultimate benefit. It's really important to have those two things together because you want to remove the causes of suffering, not just the suffering. So discernment or insight gives you some clue as to what the causes might be and how to remove them. And then, of course, the wishing to remove suffering is the immediate case. So those are the two parts of bodhicitta. When there are twos and threes of things, this is what I mean. This is why I keep things like those short phrases in. I can't keep a list of two of this and three of that in my head. I must be too old. So there are two steps one's personally accepting bodhicitta as an intention or motivation, and that's aspiration bodhicitta. That's the I want to. It's like, I want to go to New York. And then there's the application bodhicitta, and that's actually, okay, I want to go to New York, so I'm putting gas in the car, I'm packing my bag, and I'm going, and I'm driving down the road, actually doing it. So those two aspects have to go together. Aspiration bodhicitta is really good, but implementation bodhicitta is a really important piece to follow that up with. So when you're moved by something and you aspire something, find some little thing to do to actualize it. There are two ways of cultivating aspiration bodhicitta, according to Atisha. One is the accumulation of merit. Now, this is like pretty crazy. Accumulation of merit involves, in the traditional Buddhist sense, prostrations and offerings. So you say, well, I'm making prostrations to this piece of metal or this painting or this piece of wood or clay. What the heck is that going to do? And the truth is that you're seeing it in one way, but you're not seeing the way that it changes your mind. The way I like to think about it is that actually that's a representation of the Buddha. So you're building faith in this whole tradition that goes back 2,600 years that we kind of elaborated on before, and even in lifetimes before that. And also, you're prostrating to your true self. You're recognizing that you're a Buddha to be. And so that's just a representation of who you are or who you will be. Offerings, same thing. When we make offerings to a shrine or something like that, you know, what's that going to do? Same thing. It cultivates generosity towards the path. I want to give myself, I want to give my time and energy and wealth to doing this because this holds ultimate benefit for others. And by doing those things, that's what they call accumulating merit. I wish there was better language for what that does. But really, really what that is it's changing your relationship to this from being a conceptual intellectual exercise to being some way of actually involved. So you can aspire to enlightenment, maybe just doing prostrations and making offerings can be part of implementation bodhicitta for you. It's a small thing that we can all do, and it's a small step in the right direction. And sometimes, because of where we are and the limitations we have, all we can make is a small step. So that's why they say it's really important to do those things in order to cultivate this aspiration bodhicitta. So, finally, the three stages of growth are love, compassion, and bodhicitta. And love and compassion go together. Love is wanting others to be happy and have the causes of happiness. Compassion is wanting everybody to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And you look out and you realize that, hey, I want to be happy. In fact, I want all the little niggling details of happiness. I want green lights to appear on my way home. Just so that I don't have to stop and do all that kind of stuff. I want everything to be harmonious. I wanted to be happy to see the grass growing in my yard, so on and so forth, to the big things, you know. There are big things I want to. Well, every single being is like that. Not 99%, 100% want to be happy. And they want all the little things happy as well as all the big things. Same thing with suffering. Not only do I not want to experience the pain of osteoarthritis, which I have, but that seems like a big thing these days, but I don't want the pain of somebody cutting me off in traffic. I don't want the pain of, you know, being annoyed that there's a television commercial that's on too long. Everybody's like that. Everybody. And so when you contemplate that, that we're all in it together, then you can begin to get the flavor of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the only way to enlightenment in the sense that when you see things as they are, what you're seeing is that everything is interdependent, everything is connected without exception. So if I can make Don happy, it's actually making me happy. It isn't like I'm doing a big thing for Don. It's like we're in it together. There isn't actually, in some ways, two of us, right? There is, but there's not. And that's why we take the Bodhisattva vow ultimately. The Bodhisattva vow supports this path and it protects it. And the reason we take it again and again is that ultimately we're going to fail at it. Nobody does this right, probably for more than a minute a day. And so we do it again and again. And the idea is we're not vowing to be perfect Buddhas right now, this minute. Nobody expects that. That's not what we're vowing to do. What we're vowing to do is to keep making this aspiration again and again and again, and thereby cultivating our wish to grow. Cultivating the wish to grow in bodhicitta is probably the single most important thing about this whole talk. And we take a vow that we will intensify this wish. And that's what the vow is. And that's why when you break the vow, you're not breaking the vow. When you break the vow and you recognize it, you realize, oh, I want to do better. That's keeping the vow. And we take it again and again and again. So, anyway, I've used the whole thing. I told you there was a lot in this chapter, but I got through it. I'm willing to stay for a couple minutes if anybody's got any questions. I don't know, is that going to work, Mr. Sound Effects Man? Okay. If anybody has to leave, please don't be embarrassed. Do what you need to do. I talk too much.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Arvin.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, that's good. That was outstanding.
Thank you.
So I was thinking back to your talk. Try and keep this short. I'm thinking about like mind only.
Oh boy.
Versus the other stuff.
Here we go. See, this is off into the desert, but okay.
Well, right. So. Trying to think of the exact point in your talk. I've also got something else, but well, this might be enough. This might be open a can of worms. I don't know. So thinking about Trungpa, well, and like the air with how we experience the realm of appearances, I guess that's what you're getting at. So what is it? Is it mind only, or is it not mind only, or is it something in between?
Those are just labels that are convenient for scholarly work.
Okay.
Honestly.
Sure.
And they help develop understanding, I guess. But I think for the purposes of this talk, I don't want to open that can of worms right
now.
Okay,
I hear you.
All right.
I've got another short one.
Yeah.
Dharmakirti.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about Lockton.
Yeah.
So is that from Dharmakirti?
Yeah.
Is it sutra-based or is it tantric-based?
Sutra.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. I think Dharmakirti and Serlingpa are the same guy. I'm not sure. I've heard two different names for the same thing. So just want to say that. Don't know about that. So, well, thank you for being attentive for so long. I appreciate it. I hope it was a benefit. Let's take a moment now and dedicate the merit of having heard and contemplated and practiced some Dharma. May this experience of hearing, contemplating, and practicing Dharma be of benefit to ourselves and others without exception, and bring about the causes and conditions for total and complete liberation from suffering and flowering of happiness. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. For more information about the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music on this podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.